There was a time when Jesus was perhaps taking something of his ease. In the same way that we might go into a courtyard and in the sunshine just sit and enjoy watching people pass by, there were around the temple courts places where people could just sit and enjoy the company of other people. And it was at that particular sort of location that Jesus, along with some of his disciples, exactly who was present is not recorded for us, but some of his disciples, when a woman passes by them. Now, in those days, those who were widowed would have a particular style of dress which would denote the fact that they were widowed, and as this woman came into the temple, she had it in her mind to give to the work of the kingdom. She had her offering for the temple. And so she passes by Jesus and goes towards the place to drop in her offering, and out come just two of the very smallest coins available to her. It wasn't that she had chosen the least that she could possibly give, but rather it was because those were the only things that she has, and yet she drops them into the temple treasury. And although the story may not be entirely familiar with everyone, perhaps even the very term has passed into our language, or it certainly would have been in a previous generation more familiar with Bible stories to talk about the widow's mite, because that was the name that was given to these particular coins, small, insignificant coins. She had but two of them, and she dropped them both into the temple treasury. Now, for us, we're not familiar with the currency of those days, and therefore we have to, as it were, do a little bit of research into the Word of God. We find another occasion when Jesus is encouraging his disciples that are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and be of good cheer, you are worth a whole lot more than that. God knows even the hairs that are upon your head. He knows you're lying down, you're rising up. Well, that is for our comfort. But it helps us understand exactly what the value of what the widow put into the temple treasury. Because if two sparrows could be bought for a farthing, then how much could you buy with two mites? And the answer is you could buy half a sparrow. Not much of a Sunday roast out of half a sparrow. But that was all that she had. She had only sufficient. Boys and girls, think of this. All that she had was only sufficient to buy not even a whole sparrow. Half a sparrow. As Jesus sees this widow woman coming into the temple treasury, she drops in all that she has. She gives, as Jesus says, of her poverty for the work of the kingdom. The value of half the sparrow. Now, as we come to this particular portion of the Sermon on the Mount, we've arrived at a particular place in what Jesus is doing to explain the way of salvation to his hearers. What we have seen so far, just very briefly to recap, is how Jesus is explaining the way of righteousness, and if we are trusting in our own righteousness, then we are surely going to fail. So that the picture that is given to us of the rich young ruler coming to Jesus and Jesus challenging him with the law, in the same way in which we are challenged by the law every Lord's Day as we read some portion or other, whether it's from Exodus chapter 20 or Deuteronomy chapter 5 or some portion of an epistle or some portion of the gospel, even as we have read this morning that tells us of the rich young ruler. Jesus challenged the rich young ruler. He challenges his hearers in the Sermon on the Mount with their understanding of the law. In the same way that we should be challenged by the reading of the law in what Paul said from Romans. Now, if you were paying due attention, I trust you, each one of you were, you would have heard that Jesus says, you know, there's none righteous. No, not one. This is not something that he brings to the attention of those who were the most notoriously wicked in his generation, saying, there's not one of you notoriously wicked. No, he's talking to both Jew and Gentile, that there is none righteous. There's none that seeks after God. We've all gone away. Well, where then are we going to have this righteousness? Can we have it from the law? No, says Paul, explicitly, as though there were any residual doubt being left to our minds if we have been listening to what Jesus has to say in the Sermon on the Mount. Do you think that you have kept the law when it says, do not murder? Well, let me help you understand how that law is to be understood. If you have had anger and you have said, you fool, then you have broken the law. You've heard it said that you should not commit adultery. You think to yourself, well, I've never cheated on my wife, never cheated on my husband, and therefore I am guiltless of that. No, no, says Jesus, you're thinking about it again. What's going on in your heart here? Have you looked upon a maid with lust in your heart? Then you've broken the commandment. And so he explains the commandments for us, and at the end of it, even as we saw last Lord's Day, as we dealt with the commandments, saying about loving your neighbors, well, loving your enemies. Even if I can set a guard upon my heart and do all the anger management classes this world has to offer and subdue any thought of ever getting annoyed again, I'm convicted. We're each of us convicted in our hearts. We don't love our enemies. That is not something that is native to our hearts at all. And so Jesus has started, which is where we start in our services, Lord's Day by Lord's Day, by saying, well, does my righteousness rest upon my keeping of the law? And the answer is no, that the law drives us to Christ. None of us is able to put our hands up and say, no, I'm Jesus, I've kept these things even since I was a child. And yet we all still want to be at the wedding feast of the Lamb. We want a seat there. How can we have a seat at the wedding feast of the Lamb? Now, of course, as we're thinking about those sort of things, then in the flesh we want to say, well, there's all sorts of people that we expect to see there, that those who are notable philanthropists. Now, boys and girls, a fancy word, just mean people who love mankind. Those who build hospitals, endow great foundations. Even as we might have anticipated with the rich young ruler, if he had been like the sort of Bill Gates of his age, setting up a foundation and pouring millions of dollars into research against AIDS so as to provide relief from those who are afflicted in body. Or like a Carnegie who built goodness knows how many libraries around the world and gave thousands to provide millions of books. Are you telling me that those benefactors of mankind will not be given a seat in heaven because they've done all these things? Well, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. You can't buy a seat in heaven. Now, as Jesus is bringing the application of the law to bear upon his hearers, he has stripped away from them any possibility of them ever boasting in their own righteousness. Rather, he has shown us the pollution of sin, and each one of us, if we are listening to the words of Jesus, if we are, as it were, by faith, listening to the sermon that Jesus preached, we're sitting by faith at his feet and saying, now, Jesus, tell me, let me read what you have preached in your word. I want to understand it. I want to I want to apply it. Then each one of us has to say, you know, Jesus is showing me the pollution of my own heart. I'm really not doing anywhere nearly as well as I thought I was doing. All these things that I boasted of as being causes of God's goodness to me, this is why God surely must have favor upon me. This is why I'm expecting that I will receive that invitation to sit at the marriage feast of the Lamb. And there will be Carnegie, and there will be Bill Gates and Jew Season, and there will be so-and-so else who's put together all these foundations, all these hospitals that have been built, and schools that have been established, and libraries that have been for the betterment of mankind. They are great philanthropists, benefactors of mankind. They must surely all of them get a place. And Jesus says, no, that's not the basis on which you're going to get a seat in heaven. Now, if we've been listening to what Jesus has to say, we recognize that there is none that is righteous. No, not one. We sit at the feet of Jesus, and each one of us has to say, I am a sinner. All the things that I would boast in the flesh have been stripped away from me. And so when Paul, who is being challenged about his right to be an apostle, he said, you know, I have plenty of things to boast about. I, you know, I'm of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee of the Pharisees. As touching the law, I was blameless. But I count all these things but dung, I think the King James Version puts it. Paul could be fairly earthy. You know, sometimes we sort of make it rather more polite in our modern English translations, but it's the stuff that you go into the stable and shovel out. That's what he says. All his boasting was, it was just the stuff that you shovel out your stable. It's all just dung. It's the righteousness of Christ that we have to trust in. Now, as Christ is bringing us this Sermon on the Mount, and he, as it were, has stripped away from us any possibility of boasting in ourselves, if we have listened to what he has to say about the law, we come to the conclusion that there is none righteous, no, not one, that Paul is not exaggerating for the sake of effect. It's just a simple statement of the truth. Each one of us is a sinner. And what Jesus has been doing is, if I can use an illustration, he is the great physician of souls. He has, as it were, invited us into his clinic, and he's pulled off the outer layers that might hide things from his view. In the same way that we might go to a doctor, and we're dressed as we are when we go out into the street, but when we get in to see the doctor, he says, well, take off your outer garments. If we are to get at the problem, we have to look more closely at it. You have to have the physical examination. Well, there is this spiritual examination that the great physician of souls is doing, and he is laying bare all our needs. He's showing us. Now, here is the problem. The physician of souls, he says, here is the problem. Well, if you go to the doctor and you have some particular physical need, you say, well, doctor, what's the cure? How long will it take before I start to see the result of that cure in my life? But perhaps somebody who, if we could just use this as an illustration, imagine the situation. Somebody is wheeled in to see the doctor because he is incapable of walking. And the doctor says, I've got good news for you. It is curable. And I'm going to cure you of this. So he says, we're going to do the surgery. And your response is, well, how soon before I can walk again? How soon before I can walk? Well, boys and girls, I want you to see the order of things here. Because if we don't get the order right, we'll not understand the gospel message. It's as important as that. You see, it's not because we can walk that we go for surgery. It's because we can't walk that we go for surgery. And walking is the result of the surgeon's endeavors, not the cause of it. So when we come to chapter 6, what Jesus is saying, this is not, as it were, how you get to be righteous, as you practice righteousness. This is the effect of the work of God's grace in your heart. Having been convicted of our sin and coming to Christ, we then practice righteousness. And we can say it's something of a secret righteousness. Or at least that's the implication here in the context of what we're looking at. And one thing, boys and girls, straight off the page, I want you to see straight away, what is it that Jesus says? He says, when you give and when you pray. What does he not say? He doesn't say, if you give. Or if you pray. This is just something of a given. Jesus says, this is the response. Now, for those of us who had the privilege of being brought up in a Dutch Reformed background, you will remember. And those of us who have acquired the knowledge somewhat late in life will know it's guilt, grace, gratitude. It's the response of God's people. Now, it says, Jesus, when you're practicing righteousness, Jesus assumes that those whose lives have been touched by the gospel will respond. And they will respond by their giving. So when you give, says Jesus, how is that to be done? And what Jesus is saying, you know, this gets to the very, I'll use this word advisedly, it gets to the heart of motive. Or we could just simply, it really just gets to the heart. What's the basis on which we give to the work of the kingdom? Is it because we want to be seen by other men so that our names should be put on that library, the Carnegie Memorial Library? So that we can have the accolades of this world. People patting us on the back, saying, well, you're a generous-hearted man. Well, what is it? Jesus says, you know, if you do that, then you have your reward. Everybody sort of thinks well of you. You're the great philanthropist. People will want to know you because here's the man that gave that money that established this library, that hospital, that school, even that church. You had your reward, says Jesus. Don't expect any further. You've had everything that you're going to get out of that. No, says Jesus, on the contrary. What is it that's motivating your heart? It's not that you should be seen by men. It's so that you should be seen by God. It arises out of a knowledge that we have been forgiven much, and having been forgiven much, we love much. So when we read of the notorious woman who comes to the feet of Jesus and breaks the expensive ointment over his feet and allows her tears to wash her feet and then dries them with her hair, we understand when Jesus says, you know, this is a woman who has been forgiven much. I'm not, says Jesus, minimizing her sins. She has been forgiven much, but because she's been forgiven much, she loves much. Much more than Simon the Pharisee, who didn't greet Jesus with any of the things, not the least appearance, not even perhaps just the common civilities of the time. Now, says Jesus, this is someone who has been forgiven much and therefore loves much. It's how that the heart interacts with the things of God that's important. And that's why it's important for us to say, you know, it's not about the amount that you're giving, it's about what's going on in the heart. If the heart is not changed, then any amount of wealth, not supposing you were the wealthiest man in the world and gave it all away, that's not what's going to get you a seat in heaven. If the heart is wrong. Now, says Jesus, God looks upon the heart and not the outward signs. So when you're giving, when you are giving, don't do it so that other people will see an ostentatious flourishing of the large banknote as it's dropped in the plate. No, says Jesus, just as far as you are able, keep it between you and God. And when you pray, don't pray like so many other people have been praying that he knows of, standing with a loud voice so that other people could hear. Like the man who stood in the temple and said, you know, I thank you that I'm not like other men. And then listing out all the good things that you're doing. Now, says Jesus, get into your closet. In other words, get aside, apart from it. Don't wear your religion on your sleeve to be seen by other men. Enter into the secret place of prayer. Get alone with God is what he is saying. Have fellowship with your God in prayer. Now, right away, that really cuts away the ground from any idea that Jesus is just some sort of a good example for us. And that if we just follow his example of giving of himself, even of being willing to lay down our life, as Jesus laid down his life for his friends, then we are just following in his footsteps. That's not what Jesus is saying. You know, there are plenty of examples that we have encountered, perhaps in our own circle of friends, but certainly in society and so forth. Perhaps most of the world knows about Mother Teresa of Calcutta and the decades of service that she gave to the poor there, under very difficult circumstances, undertaking work that few of us would be willing to undertake. Now, one might laud her self-sacrifice and say she did an incredible amount of good to those who were poor and destitute in circumstances which none of us would favor. But in all honesty, I don't feel any degree of obligation or of gratitude towards her. She may be an example of self-sacrifice, but that does nothing for me. And I don't think it does anything for you either. You're not under any obligation because she did such an amazing work over many decades in a part of the world which was astonishingly, still is, astonishingly poor. But we're here to get today to worship and praise a God, the God of our salvation, not because he's set a good example before us, but because he has accomplished that which is impossible for man. To change hearts. And to take those who cannot ever hope to get a seat at the marriage feast of the Lamb and invite them to come to him. So as Jesus is explaining, first of all, he has brought us under conviction, the law, and now he's telling us we have to have a secret righteousness. Not displayed before the world so that everybody can see the good deeds that we are doing and have their gratitude. Not so that people should hear our prayers and think that we are wonderfully spiritual individuals. But that the righteousness that we practice, we start, first of all, by practicing it in secret. Let no one know what you are doing with your tithes and offerings. As far as you are able, keep that between you and God. And when you pray, don't look for the chief seats in the synagogues. Rather, set yourself aside when nobody knows that you're praying. And God, who sees in secret, knows your heart, will reward you. So how much, boys and girls, does it cost to get a seat at the marriage feast of the Lamb? The rich young ruler, for all his wealth, for the lands that he possessed, for the servants that he had, didn't have enough to be able to purchase a seat at the marriage feast of the Lamb. But a widow with two mites who had enough to buy half a sparrow had what it took. Because it's not about our wealth or about our righteousness. It's about God's grace poured into our hearts. The difference between the rich young ruler and the widow was a difference of heart. The rich young ruler had so much. So much, in fact, that the disciples were perplexed that if he could not enter in, then who then could be saved? It's not the amount of wealth that you have, because you are in the position to give so generously to the work of the kingdom. It's not because you have the advantages of being brought up in a Christian home or of going to a Christian school or a Christian college. It's not your family connections which will get you a place at the marriage feast of the Lamb. And it's not your outward righteousness. It's the secret righteousness of Christ. And that's exactly what Paul was saying. Who is righteous? There is none righteous, no, not one. The righteousness we have is the righteousness that comes through faith. It's the righteousness which is bestowed upon us, and not the righteousness which we achieve for ourselves. And when you practice that righteousness, when, having received the righteousness of Christ, there is an assumption that having been healed, you will walk, and walk in the ways of righteousness. So when you give, don't do it so that other people will see. Why? Because, you know, what we have received from God. We don't have it for ourselves. We only have what God has given us. So I have no grounds for boasting. I'm only giving back what God has given to me. And that helps me to understand the nature of prayer. I draw aside from the world and I get into the closet. I get into the quiet room, aside from everything and everyone. Because in fellowship with God in prayer, I only have what God gives me. I have my seat at the table of the Lord because of His grace and His mercy. And you could be as poor as a widow in Jesus' day, having only sufficient to buy half a sparrow, and yet have the approval of Jesus.